So, good morning. Very tough act to follow. But I think it's great that we're able to have someone like the Vice President of the IOC here, and I think it shows the extent to which the IOC is really genuinely engaging with these issues. Some might perhaps unfairly say that the IOC doesn't really have a great deal of choice in dealing with these issues right now, especially when confronted with questions like those in Calgary. These are questions that I once had the pleasure of having to deal with myself. I was formerly head of communications for the Olympic Games at the IOC. One of the things that we found out back then, and this was during the times of Athens, was we were already starting to have problems with how we framed the debate around major events. And I think that's something we're still seeing to this day. I was talking with the panelists upstairs earlier, and we were talking a little bit about how since Barcelona, especially the Olympic Games, have found a sort of a fairly seductive model of saying, look at these wonderful things we can deliver. Look at how a city can be transformed. And it worked really well for a while. But then afterwards, I think it started to become a little bit dangerous because, especially as we got locked into 10 years of austerity, people started to really focus on the numbers and focus on the budgets. And we started having debates solely about the numbers, and we started sort of saying, no, it's unfair that you should criticize us about these numbers. Look, part of this is operational spending, part of this is infrastructure spending, and so on. And these are parts of the debate that we hear a lot. But what we don't necessarily hear a great deal of, and what could perhaps be helpful, is to talk a little bit more about the intangibles. Because we have these events that are incredibly emotional. Fans do not connect to the Olympic Games because they are a sensible economic proposition. They connect to the Olympic Games and they connect to sports and they connect to athletes because these are people who are exploring the frontiers of human potential. And I'm interested to know, and it's something that I hope we can talk about a little with the panel this morning, about whether or not that's a part of the debate that's coming across. And because it's certainly a debate that can be won, and it can be won looking at the example here in the UK 25 years ago, where the National Lottery was starting to come online, and there was a discussion about what do we spend the money on. Do we spend the money in sports solely on infrastructure? Do we spend the money on swimming pools and on tennis courts so that we can put little blue signs on them to say this was funded by the lottery, and then everybody can point to it and say that's where the money went. We made good investments. And it was far trickier, far more dangerous to be able to say, well, no, actually, you should spend the money on people. You should give money directly to the athletes. You should give money to the coaches. And you won't have a plaque. We don't even know for sure whether the athletes are going to do better, but we should perhaps be spending some of the money on unlocking human potential. And so in the UK, we made a huge investment into that unlocking of human potential and went from 36th in the medal table in Atlanta to third in the medal table in London and second in the medal table in Rio. And now it's taken for granted in the UK that there should be hundreds of millions of pounds spent every year on high-performance sport because it's about unlocking human potential. And yet when it comes to the stages that we create where these athletes can demonstrate their potential, all of a sudden now it's about numbers. All of a sudden it's about budgets. It's about, we've moved away from the fact that it's about this unlocking of human potential. So I'm hoping that we can explore this a little bit more with the panel today. And we have Robbie from Event Scotland, we have Stuart from Auckland, we have Deborah from the OECD, we have Niels from Denmark and the European Olympic Committees, and we have Guillaume from UEFA. And I'm not going to give lengthy introductions. They're exceptionally well qualified to be here, and I'm sure that will become immediately apparent to you. So I'll allow them to encourage them to introduce themselves and perhaps share some of the insights they have.
Mark, thank you very much. My name's Robbie Clyde. I'm head of Event Scotland. I have actually been introducing myself for the last 6 months as the new Stuart Turner, and I thought I got rid of him. He moved to New Zealand, but here he is back. So I'm Robbie Clyde. He is Stuart Turner. I am no longer the new Stuart Turner. Mark, I think for me, it's a question of why. Why do cities host major events? For years, it's been around raising their international profile. It's been about the economic benefit, the social impact. Sometimes it's about just doing it because it seems like the right thing to do. But I think one of the challenges, particularly in light of the Calgary referendum last week, is at Olympic level, it has been hard for those candidate cities to really explain why they should be hosting an event of that size, scale, and cost. And I think what we have here is cities that are clear about their ambition, clear about why they want to host events, those are the most successful. And I guess maybe just to focus on here, literally here, Glasgow is an incredibly successful city at hosting events. You heard from Bridget earlier on. But Glasgow set itself out as a city that wants to host major sporting events. That's aligned with its sporting ambitions, its social regeneration policy, as we've heard earlier on, at the heart of the matter. But it is specifically targeted, won, and hosted major events that fit with the city, the city's infrastructure, its facilities, its transport. And therefore, that's why those events have been successful here. Conversely, and not really conversely, 50 miles east of here, you've got Edinburgh, the world's leading festival city, a city that has successfully set out its ambitions and clearly delivered over the last 70 years, over 70 years, some of the world's most iconic festivals. And so you have there cities that are clear and confident and mature about the events that they can deliver. And I think perhaps bringing it back to Olympics, that's one of the challenges. I think Agenda 2020 has the IOC has addressed that face on. But, and you might expect this from the IOC, it's very much from an IOC perspective, an Olympic perspective. And I think one of the challenges is about identifying events that fit the cities rather than cities that fit the events. And if I can make one comment, a bit more of an ad hoc comment based on one of the slides so earlier on, again, that three-year, four-year planning and delivery cycle, for me, that three-year planning thinking cycle should happen even before the city has delivered its candidate, to not be thinking about it once it's won the bid. That's me.
Thanks very much. Yeah, I must be the old Stuart Turner there. I work in Auckland Tourism Events Economic Development. Been there for about 9 months, so I'm going to talk about Auckland's experience rather than necessarily particularly my experience. And I think there's a couple of things just from Auckland's experience to just add to the discussion, debate. Auckland hosted World Masters Games in 2017, and it was heralded by the organisers themselves, Jens and Kai Holm, as being the best ever World Masters Games. And part of the reason for that was built into the DNA of how Auckland decided to do that event was the engagement of the citizens of Auckland. It was part of how they designed the event in the first place. It was behind their thinking about where the venues were, how the sports were set up, how the sports were run, how the volunteers were recruited. And it worked in spades. It helped them get local sponsorship. It helped the delivery. And there's a whole load of people took up sports so that they could compete in the World Masters Games. That engagement was not an accident. It was part of a design. And it's because that's what Auckland thought it wanted from the World Masters Games, over and above the fact that you get your 26,000 people who come to compete, so you're getting that international visitation anyway. The bit that would really make the difference was that design build into the DNA and a call to action for the people of the city. We want you to engage with us. We want your help in welcoming these visitors and being part of this event. I think there's lots of other cities around the world that do that. If you build it into the thought process at the beginning, it actually becomes part of the way you deliver the event. The other example I wanted to pick up, which we would have to talk about in terms of large events for Auckland, is America's Cup, which is coming up in 2021. And particularly looking at the infrastructure question, which is, you know, part of what we're focusing on there. For Auckland and New Zealand as a whole, because the government is a 50% funder of anything that's happening around America's Cup, there's been a lot of debate and deliberation, a lot of it paid out in the press around whether it's worth the money and how much we're going to spend on building this and building that. And I think that there's also then a detailed, lengthy planning process with the opportunity for pretty much anybody to object on pretty much any grounds they want to things being built. But actually, in the background, the decision's already been made that it's going to be built. So all we're doing is really building huge delays in the time process and making things difficult for ourselves. And when you start to look at that, what is about $220 million, so about £110 million, being spent on infrastructure and event around America's Cup, that sounds like a lot of money. It's 3% of the overall infrastructure development that's happening in Auckland over the next 5 years. So again, when we start to come back to how much should the public be involved in deciding that, really, why would they decide on 3% and not 97%? Are we going to hold a referendum about a light rail to the airport, about road infrastructure development, about new ferry terminals? Because actually, if we start doing that, we're never going to get anywhere. And I think that that infrastructure piece, if the infrastructure is something the city needs, then really that should be part of long-term city planning, not part of a response to an event. And I think it's really about messaging that very clearly. So those are things from Auckland's experience. I know it's not Olympic Games, but I think they're big enough scale for us that, you know, spending that amount of money on event infrastructure would be huge. But it's actually infrastructure the city already needs anyway.
Well, that's interesting, and particularly this issue about cities and governments making and populations of cities making spending decisions. I believe we have someone here from the Paris city government. And we might be able to speak a little bit more about perhaps they have a budget participatif, which is exactly what it sounds like. I wonder if, Deborah, if it's okay with you, could I jump ahead to Niels and to Guillaume, just so that they can talk a little bit about more about this idea of building in engagement for the fans right from the get-go as rights holders.
Thank you very much. My name is Niels Nagard. I'm the vice president of the European Olympic Committees, and I'm the president of the National Olympic Committee and Sports Confederation in Denmark. Thank you so much for inviting me to this very important host city conference. I think it's so important that we have these opportunities to speak together and to have these discussions about hosting the big events. And also congratulations to Glasgow and to Berlin for the successful staging of the European Championships earlier this year. I'd like to give here in the beginning just a few comments about the global and geopolitical situation concerning hosting big international events. I think there are some good news, which is that due to the global growth of the economy, we will have even more people in the future who want to go to the big events. They want to travel, they want to have entertainment, they want to have adventure. So we will experience still a big growth in the demand for these events. On the other hand, we have some very big challenges. One challenge, of course, was the financial crisis we had from 2008 onwards, which created problems many places. Another challenge is the lack of good governance in a number of international sports and also national sports federations, which has created a big problem for the perception of how international sport is working. We experienced with the Sochi Games in 2014 a very, very massive investment in infrastructure, which probably has hurt the staging of international events because this investment was so massive, and I cannot go into a discussion whether it was actually good for Sochi and Russia to do this, but it's created a perception about international sports events not being very good. Then we have the developed West and East, where in the western part of the world we have certain ways to approach these events, whereas in the East, in Asia, especially China, in the Middle East with the oil countries, in Russia and the former Soviet republics, we have a wholly, completely different approach to having these events, which also gives some challenges. As it's been told in some of the interventions so far, and especially by the IOC vice president, I believe that IOC and the Olympic movement has done really a lot of things to change the situation. But still the perception of what we are doing is that we are doing not doing enough, and people don't quite understand what we are actually doing. But I hope and I believe that this will be better in the future, and therefore that also in the Western part of the world that we will still be willing to host the big events, because there are so many benefits by doing that. So we have to go on working with that. Of course, being the vice president of European Olympic Committees, for us, a very big event are the European Games, which will be staged in Minsk in Belarus next year. And maybe on some of the question time, I can come back with some comments on that. Also next year, we have our Youth Olympic Festival taking place in Sarajevo and East Sarajevo in Bosnia-Herzegovina, which is really a fantastic history of getting the Bosnians and the Serbs to work together, and which is a very sustainable event. So there are some very good also examples that things can be done in a very good way. Thank you.
Thank you, Nils.
Good morning, everyone. Guillaume Poisson from UEFA. I will give a few explanations about my title, which is a bit special. But first of all, I'd like to say how happy I am to be here in front of you to talk about Euro 2020, which is actually one of the host city for this beautiful tournament. I seize every opportunity I have to speak about Euro because, believe it or not, beside the fact that we are the third biggest major event in the world, it's difficult to exist nowadays, considering the competition of all the other events happening in the world. So I'm responsible for the host countries and host cities in Euro 2020, so I'm doing the account management. I'm here to make sure the city maximize the positive impacts of such a tournament for the resident, for the locals, which are sometimes forgotten, to make sure that it's a fantastic event for the locals, but also for all the visitors. I've heard a lot about financial crisis since this morning, and I think this is where this idea started to shape of organizing an event with multiple hosts to share the financial burden of a tournament. To be quite frank, I've heard in the introduction, we have to be frank, there are less and less countries, football federation that can host such a big tournament. They are indeed very expensive to organize. So the ambition of UEFA was to share the financial burden of organizing these events in actually not 13 but 12 host cities. We've lost Brussels. I don't know if there's some Belgium in the room. They can also talk about the Belgium politics at halftime at the break, which is quite complex. But they didn't manage to agree on building the stadium. So UEFA has selected 12 host cities, which actually have already stadiums, except Budapest. They are currently building it, so infrastructure are existing. Now, this said, no stadium, not even Wembley, who is perceived as probably the best one in Europe, can host such a tournament without any additional investment. But let's say stadiums are existing. They are very good stadiums. Most of them host team and big matches. And same thing for host cities. We're going to 12 host cities that are able to cope with the deliverables, which are used to, have big infrastructure such as airports, public transports. So it's I don't want to say it's a minimum investment. It's still a big investment for the host cities. But let's say that looking at what was done in the past, it's much more reasonable. Now, talking about the fans, it's only post-2016, post-Euro 2016, that UEFA has decided to create a fan experience team within UEFA to really focus on the fans. Now, UEFA is very good to look after all the different population, the football family, the national teams, the corporate guests, but somehow, how much have we done really for the fans in the last few years? So for 2020, we are working very hard to enhance the experience of the fans. It's important for us that the experience of a Euro is not only the 90 minutes of what's happening on the pitch. It should be a full experience, and we're trying to invite the cities to really maximize having this event, to value it, and to make sure that it's not only 90 minutes of fun, but it's really 32 days, the whole tournament. And what you said is very right. Often the organizer focus on infrastructure, building infrastructure, but they need to have a strategy on how to communicate to the fans, how to engage the fans. The fans now are very demanding, especially the new generation. We need to match their needs. We need to understand them, and to do that, it takes a lot of time, a lot of resources, and also reinvent how we communicate to go away from this corporate approach, but more to something fun, something dynamic, and really to understand their needs. So it's in many ways at UEFA, as you understand, it's a new challenge, and we started from a white page, and we have to reinvent ourselves in many areas.
Thank you, Guillaume. I'm sure we'll come back to this question of how we communicate and what we communicate, especially to the populations of cities. Now, Deborah, with so much involved in hosting, how on earth do you wrap it up into one single coherent framework?
Okay. I've led our work on looking at global events and their impacts on local development at the OECD for the last decade. And I'm very pleased to tell Paul that as of the 30th of May of this year, the 38 member countries of the OECD under the presidency of Emmanuel Macron at our ministerial council actually approved a set of framework conditions that set the framework conditions for policy-led global events and benefits. I would hazard a guess that most people in this room, your national government has signed up to this. Your national government has adhered to it. I would urge you all to look online and take a look at it, because it is the new normal. It is the new future from a public policy perspective. And what we wanted to do with this ambitious piece of work was to work with our 38 countries, but also local stakeholders. So there are a number of people in the room who played a critical role in making this happen. The City of Paris, Gail McPherson, the International Association of Event Hosts, and the IOC. They've been with us all along. And what we do with this instrument is it sets out the necessary components in the pre-bidding, the operational phase, the delivery phase, evaluation, indicators, governance. And that includes engaging citizens. But most of all, and one of its really ambitious outcomes and outputs, is the collaborative partnership and relationship between event hosts and event owners. And so this is a very recent piece of international soft law, but it's a very important piece of international soft law. And I think how it moves forward, we want to do it in a co-creative way, just as we actually made and animated this recommendation. And I think it's an opportunity for all future hosts, but also to event owners, to really look at their own ambitions, look at the proposals they're putting forward. And at this moment in time, the relationship that we have with the head of legacy from the IOC, Tania Braga, is exceptional. You know, this is really working in a collaborative way. At a meeting that we had last week in Paris, to think about how we take this recommendation forward, how we will work with different cities. Our output and what ministers have asked us to do is to think about what are the evaluation frameworks, what are the right kinds of indicators that we need to look at, not just so that we're looking at the economic, because we're actually interested in the social, the cultural, the education, the environmental. These things have got to have an impact that goes beyond the event and goes beyond the sport or the cultural festival that is the catalyst for getting something different happening. And I think it's a really important moment in time to align the changes that are happening in the international event owners, in their governance, in their new programs, but also, as we've heard, getting the right event for the city and making it an integral part of everything else that the city plans to do, wants to do. Use it to accelerate, but also use it to change behaviour, change governance models. And those are the things that will come out of this.
Thank you. And Robbie, grabbing the mic, I suspect is because there's something you want to respond to.
Well, I mean, first of all, the document that Deborah refers to there, everybody in this room, if you haven't, you should read it. And it's not long. It's not like 500 pages of, you know, EU withdrawal documents. But it absolutely does put all the things that we've said here at the heart. It puts its cities and event hosts at the heart of why we should host major events. And I was reading it again this weekend with a certain event that we're currently looking at bidding for and thinking, are we doing that? Are we following that? And actually, for the vast majority of the recommendations in there, yes, we are. I think there's the point I really want to make is around this word legacy. And I think we've become troubled by legacy. Legacy has become this afterthought. It's become this thing that we think we should be doing. And actually, we've heard today from Paul and from others and now from Deborah about events being policy-led. That needs to be embedded from the outset. I think we should try and lose the word legacy and look at policy being embedded within events from the outset and use those events as a way of delivering and accelerating, transforming those policy initiatives, whatever they might be and whatever might be important to that host city, that host community, that country.
Thank you. Deborah, there's something else that I'd like to respond to, and you mentioned that word social, and obviously this was something that was very, very noticeable in Vice President Erdner's intervention earlier. He was talking about the Olympic Games as a social event, although interestingly went on to then talk about budgets and the new norm. I think for me there's something that there's some opportunity there in terms of enabling rights holders and cities to talk about these things in a slightly different context as social events. Now, how on earth can we make some of these intangibles tangible? What are the indicators for a successful social event?
Sorry. Thank you. I think some of the things that we can look at are around, we can look at volunteerism. The impacts that can have as you go through a societal change are really important. Someone talked about temporary employment. If you're working with hard-to-reach groups, and France did this fantastically in the Euro 2016, of working with some of the really hard-to-reach, far from the labour market, bringing them in, bringing young people in to have their first experience of employment. These are really important triggers of change. And when we took the 10 Euro 2016 cities, when I took them to Manchester and we sat on the Etihad site, the legacy of the Commonwealth Games in that location, in that city, is that for people who are hired from that locality, there is a living wage. There are training programs. There is community access to training facilities alongside elite athletes. So I think when we're looking at some of these impact benefits, we've got to think a little bit longer term. And we've got to be revisiting, because the changes that this brings about over time has other influences across the city and across the economy. And I think the ambitions for Paris 2024, if you speak to President Brusac, and forgive me, Deputy Vermatin, for referencing him, but it's his ambitions for Pleine Commune and Saint-Denis as one of the most deprived areas. And that goes back to a legacy from the World Cup in 1998. So these things don't just happen once. They can embed a series of long-term change.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think from looking at it from a sort of helicopter position coming out, we've been doing some work through the International Association of Event Hosts in terms of looking at that event measurement piece. So the framework actually talks about laying out how things should be done. But the key to it to me is that around, you know, we've probably got internationally, there's a fairly good understanding of how you measure the economic side of events. There's different ways of looking at the media and the broadcast side, but you can quantify that and get your arms around it. But what we've had to do really with the social side very much is to tell stories And there are great stories and a lot of them, but it's a very difficult way to get your message over to people who aren't already invested in what you're doing. So actually trying to create that framework where we have some social measures that can be generally used, whether that is around value of volunteer hours, whether it's about the actual, something to look at things like the cost-benefit models that people use, where we actually value the input of people's time in attending an event. They've chosen to spend their time doing that rather than something else, not just their money. And I think those things are really important for us to try and start to wrestle around as an industry. That's both the event property owners and the hosts, so that we're actually in a common view around, well, what are some of these social values in a way we can actually put a finger on. We can still tell the stories, and we should still tell the stories, but actually trying to have some kind of measures that people can universally use helps us to really put a finger on that. And I think there's a lot of work going on in that space, and it's really, really important work for us all to contribute to.
No, and I think it's also a great reminder of the importance of us, of cities and rights holders coming together in forums like this, just to discuss these sorts of things, to discuss what are the markers of social impact that we should be looking at together and moving it beyond case studies. As a rights holder, is this something that, but again, you talk about this, you know, from a cultural perspective, are there universal markers of social engagement that we can talk about, or do we need different markers for different markets? You were talking a little bit earlier, Niels, about the big cultural differences that you found even within Europe. Do you have any input on this?
Yes, of course there are different markers depending on where in Europe, where in the world you are. But I believe it's very important to look at those markers. And I think talking about voluntarism and talking about the social impact and so on are very important issues. Like in London with the games makers there, with all the volunteers, was really, really a fantastic experience for those visiting London, but also for United Kingdom itself. And there are lots of those cases you can look into. I think it's really fantastic what OECD has done now, because I'm looking besides also all the social markers and so on, because we need some objective criteria. We need some people also from outside the sports world to go in and look at these things. I'm sure that if the population of Calgary, they had read the OECD thing, they would have looked quite differently. Now they were just voting because of their feelings about their perception, about all the big problems within the Olympic world and so on. If they had actually looked into the facts, they would have voted quite differently. We see the same in Sweden about 2026, where they are hoping to have the Olympic Winter Games, but where the politicians, public in the beginning, they feel, no, it's a bad idea and things are going so wrong in the Olympic movement and it cost us a lot of money and so on. But when they actually look into the facts and see of that fantastic bit they are doing in Stockholm, this is really, really a good case. But you have to have some facts, and facts from outside, and that's one of the reasons why OECD is so important in this.
Thank you. And Guillaume, you talked a little bit earlier about how fan engagement was being designed in from a much earlier point in the process. That I imagine that automatically implies citizen engagement, but do you differentiate between fan engagement as in visiting fans and then also citizen engagement with
Yes, we do. First of all, for the local residents, their life will be affected by hosting this event, and somehow we have to we invite the cities to see how they engage the community early on and how they try to minimize the impact, and when the impact is inevitable, then how they get the support from the, you know, from the local residents. For the visiting fans, obviously one of the main objectives for the cities, it is still to attract people in their host cities, not only for match day, but for them to stay longer and to come back, you know, with families and friends. So obviously they want to show their best side, and we are helping them to promote that site. Now, regarding the visiting supporters, we felt like there was a very strong disconnect between us and them. So what we did is we, in partnership with FIFA, we did a field study in Russia, where we followed some residents from St. Petersburg, but also fans coming from different federations. Some following a specific team, some Dutch, which Netherlands were not qualified, but just they like this kind of big event, and they, independently if the team is qualified or not, they go there because they want to enjoy the event, but also to enjoy not only the football aspect, but also the cultural aspects. And I think Russia did that very well. And throughout this field study, we really got to know how these visitors and those residents consume our product. And this pushed us to reinvent how we're going to communicate to them pre-tournaments, during the tournament, and post-tournament. So we are in the middle of this analyzing all these data, all these interviews, all this research we've done in the summer to kind of reinvent ourselves for 2020 and to set a new benchmark. And right now, the Olympics in London 2012 is still the benchmark. So we, Georgina, we're going to try to raise the bar. But obviously, we need to do this together with the host cities, together with the federation. It's not just us, UEFA. It's really, it has to be embraced and supported by all the different stakeholders, locally and nationally.
So I was just going to pick up on one point, because the question you were asking at the beginning, the difference between the fans and the citizens, and I think that it's really key. It probably goes back to something Bridget said at the beginning around there are different ways to engage the citizens who are not necessarily fans of your event, and it builds on what you're saying there, Guillaume, around that they may not all be interested in watching your event product, but how can you engage them in the event? And that could be through fan zones that have cultural product in them, which would be great. It could be through messaging around the city, but actually the thinking around how do you make every citizen see the value of this, even if what they want to do is get out of the city and get away for a holiday at a time when they've got cheap flights getting out because there's lots of people coming in, it's still a value to them. And I think that it's really being able to message that it's kind of like the health service. You may not use the health service, but you think it's a good thing. We've got to be able to do that around events to say, even if you don't want to engage with this, you must be able to see the benefits. And I think we've probably talked necessarily, we've talked to some of the right audiences, but that kind of group of people who don't necessarily want to engage with the event, we still want them to think it's a good thing and to understand that there's a value to their city or to their location.
Well, and if you're looking at it from the perspective of referendums, we need them to see it as a good thing. Professor Mike Weed of the University of Canterbury did some really interesting work around London 2012, because he said, well, listen, half the people in the UK don't do any sport at all. And so from a personal perspective, they don't identify with, in the way they move their bodies, with what they're seeing on TV. They simply don't identify. And so for the 50% of people who are doing sport regularly, they identify with what they're seeing on TV and what they're seeing live through a principle known as the demonstration effect. But in order to engage the remaining 50%, who you're going to need if you want to win a referendum, then there has to be a festival effect. And the festival effect necessarily has to go beyond the sport specifically to bring in all of these cultural aspects. I am conscious of the time. I think we might have time for perhaps one or two insights or questions from the audience. Is there anybody who'd like to make a point? Yes, sir. I'll bring the microphone.
Thomas Williams from Enabling Abilities. My question is, we all know that the biggest problem within the economy is the social care and health model, and we always talk about them being a legacy of an event to aid fixing a problem in the future. But if you were to use an event to aid fixing the healthcare problem in some direct fashion, how would you do this?
Deborah, I'm wondering, I'm going to put you on the spot here. Do you have any insights as to how this social events, with a beneficial impact on health and society might go specifically to improving health outcomes in the country?
Okay. I think this comes back to the bid, the rationale for why you're bidding, and following the principle that this really has to connect with every other policy lever and intervention that you're doing. Now, quite often, cities don't have responsibility or the powers around health and well-being. However, they do have some of the softer levers that they can pull in that respect. And I think it's really important that in that pre-bidding phase, those discussions are had, that analysis is done to actually understand what are some of the health needs and what can be the potential outcomes. And we can't promise the earth. We can't say that an event this, but surely one of the things that the public sector can do that very few others can, it can make those policy linkages. It can ensure that when you are having these discussions, representatives from the health sector and from diverse range of stakeholders are involved in making at least the right recommendations and pushing the public sector as to where it needs to think more about the interventions that it makes.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. It gets to a point that Robbie made, which is that all of this good stuff can only really happen, and we know the public sector is not always the quickest. It can only happen if this sort of 3-4 year thinking about it, planning, reflection phase starts happening well before the bid even kicks off.
Yeah, no, I mean, it has to be long term. And I think the point that we're making around events being policy led is, what is the ambition? What are the aspirations of that? Whether it's healthcare policy, whether it's sport participation, whether it's cultural policy. Those ambitions are already there, those aspirations, those targets. There will be policy leads sitting in national, local government who are already working on that. How we accelerate that, or how we even create events from scratch. So we have a huge amount of experience in this room. We have a huge amount of experience, whether in Scotland, how to deliver good events. Actually, should we not be creating events that deliver on those policy aspirations rather than taking an event, whether it's the Olympics or a national championships or any other existing cultural event, and trying to fit them together, create from the ground up.
I think so. Niels?
Yeah, one more point about having this legacy, about having more people doing sport. I think one of the most important legacies for the big events is that we have to have people do more sport, more recreational sport after the events. I think we as right holders, as the ones who are having the events in different cities and countries, we can do a lot by talking about and giving good examples and so on. But in the end, it's up to the city, it's up to the government in that country actually to act. And that requires a lot. In Denmark, we are working with a big project now where we are trying together with the government to, instead of for the doctors to give out medication when you are ill or when you are recreating and so on, you give out a membership to a sports club or to a fitness center. That's much more important. And to do things like that, then we can really change something in the future.
Yeah, and this is a lot of this is driven, however, by the fitness industry, whose model is selling memberships to people who don't then actually come to the gym. So, I think we can talk at great length about these linkages with health outcomes. Deborah, you've got a burning issue.
Can I just add one more point, because I think there's also a mental health issue around this, which is really important, and we need to talk about more, but also which events can bring to the table. I had the privilege of doing some work with Derry Londonderry when it was the first UK city as UK capital of culture. And let us not forget the mental health legacy of the Troubles. It is profound. And the impact within the city and the opportunity that event gave to start to talk about some of these things, but also to help a city heal. These are really important things that again are part of all of our legacy and all of the stories that we need to be talking about.
No, that they are huge things, and they are intangible, and we do need to be talking about them more. I think we've got time perhaps for just one more question. You had your hand up earlier. Are you still keen?
Do you think there's an example of a city or country which has got the bringing the public behind them wrong, or it's failed? I could name a few, but I wonder what the panel's thoughts are.
I'll pick that up, because I think we've probably all got it wrong at some point, you know, and some on a bigger scale and more disastrous scale than others. But I think it's that the important thing is that you understand what you're trying to do. So you go back to the point that we think we've all been making consistently. So you've got that policy framework and you understand why you're doing the events you want. There's still another part to the trick, which is then to actually work out how that translates into bringing people with you. I think there's been times when all of us probably haven't got that right in terms of actually getting the message to the people. We understand why we're doing it. It does fit with the strategy. We maybe just haven't communicated it correctly. I don't think that I'm going to sit here and pillory another city just now, because that's probably not the game we like to play. But I think that the scale of those disasters is really just about how big the event is sometimes. And you know, there are also different ways that different cultures operate. You know, the idea of having a referendum in some countries wouldn't even be a question. So I think that from my point of view, we can all learn from each other's experiences, and you know, we should all put our hands up and say we've all got it wrong at some stage.
Yes, clearly there's a lot of learning for us all. I'm conscious of time. I'd like you to go away from this panel perhaps reflecting on the fact that we've spoken very little about precise budgets and a lot about intangibles. And clearly it's a lot more, it's about a lot more than just numbers and risk and money. And I think it's a message that we can all take back and bear in mind as we're communicating about our events, especially we tend to think of them as, you know, very tangible, deliverable things. We talk about deliverables and our lists of deliverables, and we have our project plans. And we can sometimes get a little bit lost in the complexities of event delivery and fail sometimes to talk about some of these wonderful intangibles. So I'd encourage you all to start talking about some of the great examples of the way these events can bring people together and the way that they can make them feel good about themselves. And join me in giving the panel a round of applause.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you all.